Up ahead, Langdon spotted the landmark he had been looking for. After crossing the Via dei Leoni, Langdon led her to the intersection of an exceptionally narrow street, more of an alleyway. The sign overhead read, Via Dante Alighieri. It sounds like you know a lot about the human brain, Langdon said. Was that your area of concentration in medical school?
No, but when I was a kid, I read a lot. I became interested in brain science because I had some medical issues.
Langdon shot her a curious look, hoping she would continue.
My brain, Sienna said quietly. It grew differently from most kids, and it caused some problems. I spent a lot of time trying to figure out what was wrong with me, and in the process, I learned a lot about neuroscience.
She caught Langdon's eye.
And yes, my baldness is related to my medical condition.
Langdon averted his eyes. Embarrassed, he'd asked.
Don't worry about it, she said. I've learned to live with it.
As they moved into the cold air of the shadowed alleyway, Langdon considered everything he had just learned about Zobrist and his alarming philosophical positions. A recurring question nagged at him. These soldiers, Langdon began, the ones trying to kill us, who are they? It makes no sense. If Zobrist has put a potential plague out there, wouldn't everyone be on the same side, working to stop its release?
Not necessarily. Zobrist may be a pariah in the medical community, but he probably has a legion of devout fans of his ideology, people who agree that a culling is a necessary evil to save the planet. For all we know, these soldiers are trying to ensure that Zobrist's vision is realized.
Zobrist's own private army of disciples? Langdon considered the possibility. Admittedly, history was full of zealots and cults who killed themselves because of all kinds of crazy notions. A belief that their leader is the Messiah. A belief that a spaceship is waiting for them behind the moon. A belief that Judgment Day is imminent. The speculation about population control was at least grounded in science, and yet something about these soldiers still didn't feel right to Langdon. I just can't believe that a bunch of trained soldiers would knowingly agree to kill innocent masses, all the while fearing they might get sick and die themselves. Sienna shot him a puzzled look.
Robert, what do you think soldiers do when they go to war? They kill innocent people and risk their own death. Anything is possible when people believe in a cause.
A cause? Releasing a plague? Sienna glanced at him, her brown eyes probing.
Robert, the cause is not releasing a plague. It's saving the world.
She paused.
One of the passages in Bertrand Zobrist's essay that got a lot of people talking was a very pointed hypothetical question. I want you to answer it.
What's the question?
Zobrist asked the following. If you could throw a switch and randomly kill half the population on Earth, would you do it?
Of course not.
Okay. But what if you were told that if you didn't throw that switch right now, the human race would be extinct in the next 100 years?
She paused.
Would you throw it then, even if it meant you might murder friends, family, and possibly even yourself?
Sienna, I can't possibly...
It's a hypothetical question, she said. Would you kill half the population today in order to save our species from extinction?
Langdon felt deeply disturbed by the macabre subject they were discussing, and so he was grateful to see a familiar red banner hanging on the side of a stone building just ahead. Look, he announced, pointing. We're here. Sienna shook her head.
Like I said, denial.
Chapter 51. The Casa di Dante is located on the Via Santa Margherita and is easily identified by the large banner suspended from the stone facade partway up the alleyway. Museo Casa di Dante. Sienna eyed the banner with uncertainty.
We're going to Dante's house?
Not exactly, Langdon said. Dante lived around the corner. This is more of a Dante museum. Langdon had ventured inside the place once, curious about the art collection, which turned out to be no more than reproductions of famous Dante-related works from around the world, and yet it was interesting to see them all gathered together under one roof. Sienna looked suddenly hopeful.
And you think they have an ancient copy of the Divine Comedy on display?
Langdon chuckled. No. but I know they have a gift shop that sells huge posters with the entire text of Dante's Divine Comedy printed in microscopic type." She gave him a slightly appalled glance. "I know, but it's better than nothing. The only problem is that my eyes are going, so you'll have to read the fine print."
"Eccusa,"
an old man called out, seeing them approach the door.
"E il giorno di riposo?"
"Closed for the Sabbath?" Langdon felt suddenly disoriented again. He looked at Sienna. "Isn't today Monday?" She nodded.
"Florentines prefer a Monday Sabbath."
Langdon groaned, suddenly recalling the city's unusual weekly calendar. Because tourist dollars flowed most heavily on weekends, many Florentine merchants chose to move the Christian day of rest from Sunday to Monday to prevent the Sabbath from cutting too deeply into their bottom line. Unfortunately, Langdon realized, this probably also ruled out his other option, the paperback exchange. One of Langdon's favorite Florentine bookshops, which would definitely have had copies of the Divine Comedy on hand.
"Any other ideas?" Sienna said.
Langdon thought a long moment and finally nodded. "There's a site just around the corner where Dante enthusiasts gather. I bet someone there has a copy we can borrow."
"It's probably closed too," Sienna warned. "Almost every place in town moves the Sabbath away from Sunday."
"This place wouldn't dream of doing such a thing," Langdon replied with a smile. "It's a church." 50 yards behind them, lurking among the crowd, the man with the skin rash and gold earring leaned on a wall, savoring this chance to catch his breath. His breathing was not getting any better, and the rash on his face was nearly impossible to ignore, especially the sensitive skin just above his eyes. He took off his plume Paris glasses and gently rubbed his sleeve across his eye sockets, trying not to break the skin. When he replaced his glasses, he could see his quarry moving on. Forcing himself to follow, he continued after them, breathing as gently as possible. Several blocks behind Langdon and Sienna, inside the Hall of the 500, Agent Bruder stood over the broken body of the all-too-familiar spike-haired woman who was now lying sprawled out on the floor. He knelt down and retrieved her handgun, carefully removing the clip for safety before handing it off to one of his men. The pregnant museum administrator, Marta Alvarez, stood off to one side. She had just relayed to Bruder a brief but startling account of what had transpired with Robert Langdon since the previous night, including a single piece of information that Bruder was still trying to process.
"Langdon claims to have amnesia."
Bruder pulled out his phone and dialed. The line at the other end rang 3 times before his boss answered, sounding distant and unsteady.
"Yes, Agent Bruder, go ahead."
Bruder spoke slowly to ensure that his every word was understood.
"We are still trying to locate Langdon and the girl, but there's been another development."
Bruder paused.
"And if it's true, it changes everything."
The provost paced his office, fighting the temptation to pour himself another scotch, forcing himself to face this growing crisis head on. Never in his career had he betrayed a client or failed to keep an agreement, and he most certainly had no intention of starting now. At the same time, he suspected that he might have gotten himself tangled up in a scenario whose purpose diverged from what he had originally imagined. 1 year ago, the famous geneticist Bertrand Zobrist had come aboard the Mendacium and requested a safe haven in which to work. At that time, the provost imagined that Zobrist was planning to develop a secret medical procedure whose patenting would increase Zobrist's vast fortune. It would not be the first time the consortium had been hired by paranoid scientists and engineers who preferred working in extreme isolation to prevent their valuable ideas from being stolen. With that in mind, the provost accepted the client and was not surprised when he learned that the people at the World Health Organization had begun searching for him. Nor did he give it a second thought when the director of the WHO herself, Dr. Elizabeth Sinsky, seemed to make it her personal mission to locate their client.
"The consortium has always faced powerful adversaries."
As agreed, the consortium carried out their agreement with Zobrist, no questions asked,
thwarting Sinsky's efforts to find him for the entire length of the scientist's contract. Almost the entire length. Less than a week before the contract was to expire, Sinsky had somehow located Zobrist in Florence and moved in, harassing and chasing him until he committed suicide. For the first time in his career, the provost had failed to provide the protection he had agreed to, and it haunted him, along with the bizarre circumstances of Zobrist's death. He committed suicide rather than being captured? What the hell was Zobrist protecting? In the aftermath of his death, Sinsky had confiscated an item from Zobrist's safe deposit box, and now the consortium was locked in a head-to-head battle with Sinsky in Florence, a high-stakes treasure hunt to find... To find what? The provost felt himself glance instinctively toward the bookshelf and the heavy tome given to him 2 weeks ago by the wild-eyed Zobrist. The Divine Comedy. The provost retrieved the book and carried it back to his desk, where he dropped it with a heavy thud. With unsteady fingers, he opened the cover to the first page and again read the inscription. My dear friend, thank you for helping me find the path. The world thanks you, too. First off, the provost thought, you and I were never friends. He read the inscription 3 more times. Then he turned his eyes to the bright red circle his client had scrawled on his calendar, highlighting tomorrow's date. The world thanks you? He turned and gazed out at the horizon a long moment. In the silence, he thought about the video and heard the voice of facilitator Knowlton from his earlier phone call. I thought you might want to preview it before upload. The content is quite disturbing. The call still puzzled the provost. Knowlton was one of his best facilitators, and making such a request was entirely out of character. He knew better than to suggest an override of the compartmentalization protocol. After replacing the Divine Comedy on the shelf, the provost walked to the scotch bottle and poured himself half a glass. He had a very difficult decision to make. Chapter 52. Known as the Church of Dante, the sanctuary of Chiesa di Santa Margherita dei Cerchi is more of a chapel than a church. The tiny one-room house of worship is a popular destination for devotees of Dante who revere it as the sacred ground on which transpired 2 pivotal moments in the great poet's life. According to lore, it was here at this church, at the age of 9, that Dante first laid eyes on Beatrice Portinari, the woman with whom he fell in love at first sight and for whom his heart ached his entire life. To Dante's great anguish, Beatrice married another man and then died at the youthful age of 24. It was also in this church, some years later, that Dante married Gemma Donati, a woman who, even by the account of the great writer and poet Boccaccio, was a poor choice of wife for Dante. Despite having children, the couple showed little signs of affection for each other. And after Dante's exile, neither spouse seemed eager to see the other ever again. The love of Dante's life had always been and would always remain the departed Beatrice Portinari, whom Dante had scarcely known, and yet whose memory was so overpowering for him that her ghost became the muse that inspired his greatest works. Dante's celebrated volume of poetry, La Vita Nuova, overflows with flattering verses about the blessed Beatrice. More worshipful still, the Divine Comedy casts Beatrice as none other than the Savior who guides Dante through paradise. In both works, Dante longs for his unattainable lady. Nowadays, the Church of Dante has become a shrine for the brokenhearted who suffer from unrequited love. The tomb of young Beatrice herself is inside the church, and her simple sepulcher has become a pilgrimage destination for both Dante fans and heartsick lovers alike. This morning, as Langdon and Sienna wound their way through old Florence toward the church, the streets continued to narrow until they became little more than glorified pedestrian walkways. An occasional local car appeared, inching through the maze and forcing pedestrians to flatten themselves against the buildings as it passed. The church is just around the corner, Langdon told Sienna, hopeful that one of the tourists inside would be able to help them. He knew their chances of finding a good Samaritan were better now that Sienna had taken back her wig in exchange for Langdon's jacket, and both had reverted to their normal selves, transforming from rocker and skinhead to college professor and clean-cut young woman. Langdon was relieved once again to feel like himself. As they strode into an even tighter alleyway, the Via del Presto, Langdon scanned the various doorways. The entrance of the church was always tricky to locate because the building itself was very small, unadorned, and wedged tightly between two other buildings. One could easily walk past it without even noticing. Oddly, it was often easier to locate this church using not one's eyes, but one's ears. One of the peculiarities of La Chiesa di Santa Margherita dei Cerchi was that it hosted frequent concerts, and when no concert was scheduled, the church piped in recordings of those concerts so visitors could enjoy the music at any time. As anticipated, as they advanced down the alleyway, Langdon began to hear the thin strains of recorded music, which grew steadily louder, until he and Sienna were standing before the inconspicuous entrance. The only indication that this was indeed the correct location was a tiny sign, the antithesis of the bright red banner at the Museo Casa di Dante, that humbly announced that this was the church of Dante and Beatrice. When Langdon and Sienna stepped off the street into the dark confines of the church, the air grew cooler and the music grew louder. The interior was stark and simple, smaller than Langdon recalled. There was only a handful of tourists, mingling, writing in journals, sitting quietly in the pews enjoying the music, or examining the curious collection of artwork. With the exception of the Madonna-themed altarpiece by Neri de Bicci, almost all of the original art in this chapel had been replaced with contemporary pieces representing the two celebrities, Dante and Beatrice, the reasons most visitors sought out this tiny chapel. Most of the paintings depicted Dante's longing gaze during his famous first encounter with Beatrice, during which the poet, by his own account, instantly fell in love. The paintings were of widely varying quality, and most, to Langdon's taste, seemed kitschy and out of place. In one such rendering, Dante's iconic red cap with ear flaps looked like something Dante had stolen from Santa Claus. Nonetheless, the recurring theme of the poet's yearning gaze at his muse Beatrice left no doubt that this was a church of painful love, unfulfilled, unrequited, and unattained. Langdon turned instinctively to his left and gazed upon the modest tomb of Beatrice Portinari. This was the primary reason people visited this church, although not so much to see the tomb itself as to see the famous object that sat beside it, a wicker basket. This morning, as always, the simple wicker basket sat beside Beatrice's tomb. And this morning, as always, it was overflowing with folded slips of paper, each a handwritten letter from a visitor, written to Beatrice herself. Beatrice Portinari had become something of a patron saint of star-crossed lovers, and according to long-standing tradition, handwritten prayers to Beatrice could be deposited in the basket in the hope that she would intervene on the writer's behalf, perhaps inspiring someone to love them more, or helping them find their true love, or even giving them the strength to forget a love who had passed away. Langdon, many years ago, while in the throes of researching a book on art history, had paused in this church to leave a note in the basket, entreating Dante's muse not to grant him true love, but to shed on him some of the inspiration that had enabled Dante to write his massive tome. Sing in me, muse, and through me tell the story. The opening line of Homer's Odyssey had seemed a worthy supplication, and Langdon secretly believed his message had indeed sparked Beatrice's divine inspiration, for upon his return home, he had written the book with unusual ease.
Scusate,
Sienna's voice boomed suddenly.
Potete ascoltarmi tutti?
Everyone. Langdon spun to see Sienna loudly addressing the scattering of tourists, all of whom now glanced over at her, looking somewhat alarmed. Sienna smiled sweetly at everyone and asked in Italian if anyone happened to have a copy of Dante's Divine Comedy. After some strange looks and shakes of the head, she tried the question in English without any more success. An older woman who was sweeping the altar hissed sharply at Sienna and held up a finger to her lips for silence. Sienna turned back to Langdon and frowned as if to say, "Now what?" Sienna's calling all cars solicitation was not quite what Langdon had had in mind, but he had to admit he'd anticipated a better response than she'd received. On previous visits, Langdon had seen no shortage of tourists reading the Divine Comedy in this hallowed space, apparently enjoying a total immersion in the Dante experience. Not so today. Langdon set his sights on an elderly couple seated near the front of the church. The old man's bald head was dipped forward, chin to chest. Clearly, he was stealing a nap. The woman beside him seemed very much awake, with a pair of white earbud cables dangling from beneath her gray hair. A glimmer of promise, Langdon thought, making his way up the aisle until he was even with the couple. As Langdon had hoped, the woman's telltale white earbuds snaked down to an iPhone in her lap. Sensing she was being watched, she looked up and pulled the earbuds from her ears. Langdon had no idea what language the woman spoke, but the global proliferation of iPhones, iPads, and iPods had resulted in a vocabulary as universally understood as the male-female symbols that graced restrooms around the world. "iPhone?" Langdon asked, admiring her device. The old woman brightened at once, nodding proudly.
"Such a clever little toy," she whispered in a British accent. "My son got it for me. I'm listening to my email. Can you believe it? Listening to my email? This little treasure actually reads it for me. With my old eyes, it's such a help."
"I have one too," Langdon said with a smile as he sat down beside her, careful not to wake up her sleeping husband. "But somehow I lost it last night."
"Oh, tragedy. Did you try the Find Your iPhone feature? My son says..."
"Stupid me, I never activated that feature." Langdon gave her a sheepish look and ventured hesitantly, "If it's not too much of an intrusion, would you mind terribly if I borrowed yours for just a moment? I need to look up something online." "It would be a big help to me."
"Of course."
She pulled out the earbuds and thrust the device into his hands.
"No problem at all, poor dear."
Langdon thanked her and took the phone. While she prattled on beside him about how terrible she would feel if she lost her iPhone, Langdon pulled up Google's search window and pressed the microphone button. When the phone beeped once, Langdon articulated his search string. "Dante, Divine Comedy, Paradise, Canto 25. The woman looked amazed, apparently having yet to learn about this feature. As the search results began to materialize on the tiny screen, Langdon stole a quick glance back at Sienna, who was thumbing through some printed material near the basket of letters to Beatrice. Not far from where Sienna stood, a man in a necktie was kneeling in the shadows, praying intently, his head bowed low. Langdon couldn't see his face, but he felt a pang of sadness for the solitary man, who had probably lost his loved one and had come here for comfort. Langdon returned his focus to the iPhone, and within seconds was able to pull up a link to a digital offering of the Divine Comedy, freely accessible because it was in the public domain. When the page opened precisely to Canto 25, he had to admit he was impressed with the technology. "I've got to stop being such a snob about leather-bound books," he reminded himself. "E-books do have their moments." As the elderly woman looked on, showing a bit of concern and saying something about the high data rates for surfing the internet abroad, Langdon sensed that his window of opportunity would be brief, and he focused intently on the web page before him. The text was small, but the dim lighting in the chapel made the illuminated screen more legible. Langdon was pleased to see he had randomly stumbled into the Mandelbaum translation, a popular modern rendition by the late American professor Alan Mandelbaum. For his dazzling translation, Mandelbaum had received Italy's highest honor, the Presidential Cross of the Order of the Star of Italian Solidarity. While admittedly less overtly poetic than Longfellow's version, Mandelbaum's translation tended to be far more comprehensible. "Today I'll take clarity over poesy," Langdon thought, hoping to quickly spot in the text a reference to a specific location in Florence, the location where Ignazio hid the Dante death mask. The iPhone's tiny screen displayed only 6 lines of text at a time, and as Langdon began to read,
he recalled the passage. In the opening of Canto 25, Dante referenced the Divine Comedy itself, the physical toll its writing had taken on him, and the aching hope that perhaps his heavenly poem could overcome the wolfish brutality of the exile that kept him from his fair Florence. Canto 25. If it should happen, if this sacred poem, this work so shared by heaven and by earth, that it has made me lean through these long years, can ever overcome the cruelty that bars me from the fair fold where I slept, a lamb opposed to wolves that war on it. While the passage was a reminder that fair Florence was the home for which Dante longed while writing the Divine Comedy, Langdon saw no reference to any specific location in the city.
What do you know about data charges?
The woman interrupted, eyeing her iPhone with sudden concern.
I just remembered my son told me to be careful about web surfing abroad.
Langdon assured her he would be only a minute and offered to reimburse her. But even so, he sensed she would never let him read all 100 lines of Canto 25. He quickly scrolled down to the next 6 lines and continued reading. By then, with other voice, with other fleece, I shall return as poet and put on, at my baptismal font, the laurel crown. For there I first found entry to that faith which makes souls welcome unto God. And then, for that faith, Peter garlanded my brow. Langdon loosely recalled this passage, too, an oblique reference to a political deal offered to Dante by his enemies. According to history, the wolves who banished Dante from Florence had told him he could return to the city only if he agreed to endure a public shaming, that of standing before an entire congregation, alone at his baptismal font, wearing only sackcloth as an admission of his guilt. In the passage Langdon had just read, Dante, having declined the deal, proclaims that if he ever returns to his baptismal font, he will be wearing not the sackcloth of a guilty man, but the laurel crown of a poet. Langdon raised his index finger to scroll farther, but the woman suddenly protested, holding out her hand for the iPhone, apparently having reconsidered her loan. Langdon barely heard her. In the split second before he had touched the screen, his eye had glossed over a line of text, seeing it a second time. I shall return as poet and put on, at my baptismal font, the laurel crown. Langdon stared at the words, sensing that in his eagerness to find mention of a specific location, he'd almost missed a glowing prospect in the very opening lines. At my baptismal font. Florence was home to one of the world's most celebrated baptismal fonts, which for more than 700 years had been used to purify and christen young Florentines, among them Dante Alighieri. Langdon immediately conjured an image of the building containing the font. It was a spectacular octagonal edifice that in many ways was more heavenly than the Duomo itself. He now wondered if perhaps he'd read all he needed to read. Could this building be the place Ignazio was referring to? A ray of golden light blazed now in Langdon's mind as a beautiful image materialized, a spectacular set of bronze doors, radiant and glistening in the morning sun. I know what Ignazio was trying to tell me. Any lingering doubts evaporated an instant later when he realized that Ignazio Busoni was one of the only people in Florence who could possibly unlock those doors. Robert, the gates are open to you, but you must hurry. Langdon handed the iPhone back to the old woman and thanked her profusely. He rushed over to Siena and whispered excitedly, I know what gates Ignazio was talking about. The gates of paradise. Siena looked dubious. The gates of paradise? Aren't those in heaven? Actually, Langdon said, giving her a wry smile and heading for the door. If you know where to look, Florence is heaven. Chapter 53. I shall return as poet at my baptismal font. Dante's words echoed repeatedly in Langdon's mind as he led Siena northward along the narrow passageway known as Via dello Studio. Their destination lay ahead, and with every step Langdon was feeling more confident that they were on the right course and had left their pursuers behind. The gates are open to you, but you must hurry. As they neared the end of the chasm-like alleyway, Langdon could already hear the low thrum of activity ahead. Abruptly, the cavern on either side of them gave way, spilling them out into a sprawling expanse, the Piazza del Duomo. This enormous plaza, with its complex network of structures, was the ancient religious center of Florence. More of a tourist center nowadays, the piazza was already bustling with tour buses and throngs of visitors crowding around Florence's famed cathedral. Having arrived on the south side of the piazza, Langdon and Sienna were now facing the side of the cathedral with its dazzling exterior of green, pink, and white marble. As breathtaking in its size as it was in the artistry that had gone into its construction, the cathedral stretched off in both directions to seemingly impossible distances. Its full length, nearly equal to that of the Washington Monument laid on its side. Despite its abandonment of traditional monochromatic stone filigree in favor of an unusually flamboyant mix of colors, the structure was pure Gothic, classic, robust, and enduring. Admittedly, Langdon, on his first trip to Florence, had found the architecture almost gaudy. On subsequent trips, however, he found himself studying the structure for hours at a time, strangely captivated by its unusual aesthetic effects, and finally appreciating its spectacular beauty. Il Duomo, or more formally, the Cathedral of Santa Maria del Fiore, in addition to providing a nickname for Ignazio Busoni, had long provided not only a spiritual heart to Florence, but centuries of drama and intrigue. The building's volatile past ranged from long and vicious debates over Vasari's much-despised fresco of the Last Judgment on the dome's interior to the hotly disputed competition to select the architect to finish the dome itself. Filippo Brunelleschi had eventually secured the lucrative contract and completed the dome, the largest of its kind at the time. And to this day, Brunelleschi himself can be seen in sculpture seated outside the Palazzo dei Canonici, staring contentedly up at his masterpiece. This morning, as Langdon raised his eyes skyward to the famed red-tiled dome that had been an architectural feat of its era, he recalled the time he had foolishly decided to ascend the dome only to discover that its narrow, tourist-crammed staircases were as distressing as any of the claustrophobic spaces he'd ever encountered. Even so, Langdon was grateful for the ordeal he'd endured while climbing Brunelleschi's dome, since it had encouraged him to read an entertaining Ross King book of the same name.
"Robert," Sienna said, "are you coming?"
Langdon lowered his gaze from the dome, realizing he had stopped in his tracks to admire the architecture. "Sorry about that." They continued moving, hugging the perimeter of the square. The cathedral was on their right now, and Langdon noted that tourists were already flowing out of its side exits, checking the site off their to-see lists. Up ahead rose the unmistakable shape of a campanile, the second of the three structures in the cathedral complex. Commonly known as Giotto's Bell Tower, the campanile left no doubt that it belonged with the cathedral beside it. Adorned in the identical pink, green, and white facing stones, the square spire climbed skyward to a dizzying height of nearly 300 feet. Langdon had always found it amazing that this slender structure could remain standing all these centuries, through earthquakes and bad weather, especially knowing how top-heavy it was, with its apex belfry supporting more than 20,000 pounds of bells. Sienna walked briskly beside him, her eyes nervously scanning the skies beyond the campanile, clearly searching for the drone, but it was nowhere to be seen. The crowd was fairly dense even at this early hour, and Langdon made a point of staying in the thick of it. As they approached the campanile, they passed a line of caricature artists standing at their easels, sketching garish cartoons of tourists. A teenage boy grinding on a skateboard, a horse-toothed girl wielding a lacrosse stick, a pair of honeymooners kissing on a unicorn. Langdon found it amusing somehow that this activity was permitted on the same sacred cobbles where Michelangelo had set up his own easel as a boy. Continuing quickly around the base of Giotto's bell tower, Langdon and Sienna turned right, moving out across the open square directly in front of the cathedral. Here the crowds were thickest, with tourists from around the world aiming camera phones and video cameras upward at the colorful main facade. Langdon barely glanced up, having already set his sights on a much smaller building that had just come into view. Positioned directly opposite the front entrance of the cathedral stood the third and final structure in the cathedral complex. It was also Langdon's favorite, the baptistry of San Giovanni. Adorned in the same polychromatic facing stones and striped pilasters as the cathedral, the baptistry distinguished itself from the larger building by its striking shape, a perfect octagon. Resembling a layer cake, some had claimed, the eight-sided structure consisted of three distinct tiers that ascended to a shallow white roof. Langdon knew the octagonal shape had nothing to do with aesthetics and everything to do with symbolism. In Christianity, the number eight represented rebirth and recreation. The octagon served as a visual reminder of the 6 days of God's creation of heaven and earth, the one day of Sabbath, and the eighth day upon which Christians were reborn or recreated through baptism. Octagons had become a common shape for baptistries around the world. While Langdon considered the baptistry one of Florence's most striking buildings, he always found the choice of its location a bit unfair. This baptistry, nearly anywhere else on earth, would be the center of attention. Here, however, in the shadow of its two colossal siblings, the baptistry gave the impression of being the runt of the litter. "Until you step inside," Langdon reminded himself, picturing the mind-boggling mosaic work of the interior, which was so spectacular that early admirers claimed the baptistry ceiling resembled heaven itself. "If you know where to look," Langdon had wryly told Sienna, "Florence is heaven." For centuries, this eight-sided sanctuary had hosted the baptisms of countless notable figures, Dante among them. "I shall return as poet at my baptismal font." Because of his exile, Dante had never been permitted to return to this sacred site, the place of his baptism, although Langdon felt a rising hope that Dante's death mask, through the unlikely series of events that had occurred last night, had finally found its way back in his stead. "The baptistry," Langdon thought. "This has to be where Ignazio hid the mask before he died." He recalled Ignazio's desperate phone message, and for a chilling moment, Langdon pictured the corpulent man clutching his chest, lurching across the piazza into an alley, and making his final phone call after leaving the mask safely inside the baptistry. "The gates are open to you." Langdon's eyes remained fixed on the baptistry as he and Sienna snaked through the crowd. Sienna was moving now with such nimble eagerness that Langdon nearly had to jog to keep up. Even at a distance, he could see the baptistry's massive main doors glistening in the sun. Crafted of gilded bronze and over 15 feet tall, the doors had taken Lorenzo Ghiberti more than 20 years to complete. They were adorned with 10 intricate panels of delicate biblical figures of such quality that Giorgio Vasari had called the doors undeniably perfect in every way and the finest masterpiece ever created. It had been Michelangelo, however, whose gushing testimonial had provided the doors with a nickname that endured even today. Michelangelo had proclaimed them so beautiful as to be fit for use as the gates of paradise. Chapter 54. The Bible in bronze, Langdon thought, admiring the beautiful doors before them. Ghiberti's shimmering gates of paradise consisted of 10 square panels, each depicting an important scene from the Old Testament. Ranging from the Garden of Eden to Moses to King Solomon's temple, Ghiberti's sculpted narrative unfolded across two vertical columns of 5 panels each. The stunning array of individual scenes had spawned over the centuries something of a popularity contest among artists and art historians, with everyone from Botticelli to modern-day critics arguing their preference for the finest panel. The winner, by general consensus over the centuries, had been Jacob and Esau, the central panel of the left-hand column, chosen allegedly for the impressive number of artistic methods used in its making. Langdon suspected, however, that the actual reason for the panel's dominance was that Ghiberti had chosen it on which to sign his name. A few years earlier, Ignazio Busoni had proudly shown Langdon these doors, sheepishly admitting that after half a millennium of exposure to floods, vandalism, and air pollution, the gilded doors had been quietly swapped out for exact replicas, the originals now safely stored inside the Museo dell'Opera del Duomo for restoration. Langdon politely refrained from telling Busoni that he was well aware of the fact that they were admiring fakes, and that in actuality, these copies were the second set of fake Ghiberti doors Langdon had encountered, the first set quite by accident while he was researching the labyrinths at Grace Cathedral in San Francisco, and discovered that replicas of Ghiberti's Gates of Paradise had served as the cathedral's front doors since the mid-20th century. As Langdon stood before Ghiberti's masterpiece, his eye was drawn to the short informational placard mounted nearby, on which a simple phrase in Italian caught his attention, startling him. La peste nera. The phrase meant the Black Death. My God, Langdon thought, it's everywhere I turn. According to the placard, the doors had been commissioned as a votive offering to God, a show of gratitude that Florence had somehow survived the plague. Langdon forced his eyes back to the Gates of Paradise, while Ignazio's words echoed again in his mind. The gates are open to you, but you must hurry. Despite Ignazio's promise, the Gates of Paradise were definitely closed, as they always were, except for rare religious holidays. Normally, tourists entered the baptistry from a different side, through the north door. Sienna was on tiptoe beside him, trying to see around the crowd.
There's no door handle, she said. No keyhole, nothing.
True, Langdon thought. Knowing Ghiberti was not about to ruin his masterpiece with something as mundane as a doorknob. The doors swing in. They lock from the inside.
Sienna thought a moment, pursing her lips. So from out here, nobody would know if the doors were locked or not.
Langdon nodded. I'm hoping that's precisely Ignazio's thinking. He walked a few steps to his right and glanced around the north side of the building to a far less ornate door. The tourist entrance, where a bored-looking docent was smoking a cigarette and rebuffing inquiring tourists by pointing to the sign on the entrance. Apertura, 1300 to 1700 hours. It doesn't open for several hours, Langdon thought, pleased, and nobody has been inside yet. Instinctively, he checked his wristwatch and was again reminded that Mickey Mouse was gone. When he returned to Siena, she had been joined by a group of tourists who were taking photos through the simple iron fence that had been erected several feet in front of the Gates of Paradise to prevent tourists from getting too close to Ghiberti's masterwork. This protective gate was made of black wrought iron topped with sunray spikes dipped in gold paint and resembled the simple estate fencing that often enclosed suburban homes. Ambiguously, the informational placard describing the Gates of Paradise had been mounted not on the spectacular bronze doors themselves, but on this very ordinary protective gate. Langdon had heard that the placard's placement sometimes caused confusion among tourists. And sure enough, just then, a chunky woman in a juicy couture sweatsuit pushed through the crowd, glanced at the placard, frowned at the wrought iron gate, and scoffed,
"Gates of Paradise? Hell, it looks like my dog fence at home."
Then she toddled off before anyone could explain. Sienna reached up and grasped the protective gate, casually peering through the bars at the locking mechanism on the back.
"Look," she whispered, turning wide-eyed to Langdon. "The padlock on the back is unlocked."
Langdon looked through the bars and saw she was right. The padlock was positioned as if it were locked, but on closer inspection he could see that it was definitely unlocked. "The gates are open to you, but you must hurry." Langdon raised his eyes to the Gates of Paradise beyond the fencing. If Ignazio had indeed left the baptistry's huge doors unbolted, they should simply swing open. The challenge, however, would be getting inside without drawing the attention of every single person in the square, including, no doubt, the police and Duomo guards.
"Look out!" a woman suddenly screamed nearby. "He's going to jump!"
Her voice was filled with terror.
"Up there on the bell tower!"
Langdon spun now from the doors and saw that the woman shouting was Sienna. She stood 5 yards away, pointing up into Giotto's bell tower and shouting,
"There at the top, he's going to jump!"
Every set of eyes turned skyward, searching the top of the bell tower. Nearby, others began pointing, squinting. calling out to one another.
Someone is jumping? Where? I don't see him. Over there on the left.
It took only seconds for people across the square to sense the panic and follow suit, staring up at the top of the bell tower. With the fury of a wildfire consuming a parched hayfield, the rush of fear billowed out across the piazza until the entire crowd was craning their necks, looking upward and pointing. Viral marketing, Langdon thought, knowing he'd have only a moment to act. Immediately he grabbed the wrought iron fence and swung it open, just as Sienna returned to his side and slipped with him into the small space beyond. Once the gate was closed behind them, they turned to face the 15-foot bronze doors. Hoping he had understood Ignazio correctly, Langdon threw his shoulder into one side of the massive double doors and drove his legs hard. Nothing happened, and then, painfully slowly, the cumbersome section began to move.
The doors are open.
The gates of paradise swung open about 1 foot, and Sienna wasted no time turning sideways and slipping through. Langdon followed suit, inching sideways through the narrow opening into the darkness of the baptistry. Together they turned and heaved the door in the opposite direction, quickly closing the massive portal with a definitive thud. Instantly, the noise and chaos outside evaporated, leaving only silence. Sienna pointed to a long wooden beam on the floor at their feet, which clearly had been set in side brackets on either side of the door to serve as a barricade.
Ignazio must have removed it for you, she said.
Together, they lifted the beam and dropped it back into its brackets, effectively locking the gates of paradise and sealing themselves safely inside. For a long moment, Langdon and Sienna stood in silence, leaning against the door and catching their breath. Compared to the noises of the piazza outside, the interior of the baptistry felt as peaceful as heaven itself. Outside the baptistry of San Giovanni, the man in the plume Paris spectacles and paisley necktie moved through the crowd, ignoring the uneasy stares of those who noticed his bloody rash. He had just reached the bronze doors through which Robert Langdon and his blonde companion had cleverly disappeared. Even from outside, he had heard the heavy thud of the doors being barred from within. No entry this way. Slowly, the ambience in the piazza was returning to normal. The tourists, who had been staring upward in anticipation, were now losing interest. No jumper. Everyone moved on. The man was itchy again, his rash getting worse. Now his fingertips were swollen and cracking as well. He slid his hands into his pockets to keep himself from scratching. His chest continued to throb as he began circling the octagon in search of another entrance. He had barely made it around the corner when he felt a sharp pain on his Adam's apple and realized he was scratching again. Chapter 55. Legend proclaims that it is physically impossible upon entering the baptistry of San Giovanni not to look up. Langdon, despite having been in this room many times, now felt the mystical pull of the space and let his gaze climb skyward to the ceiling. High, high overhead, the surface of the baptistry's octagonal vault spanned more than 80 feet from side to side. It glistened and shimmered as if it were made of smoldering coals. Its burnished amber-gold surface reflected the ambient light unevenly from more than 1 million smalti tiles. Tiny, ungrouted mosaic pieces hand-cut from a glassy silica glaze, which were arranged in 6 concentric rings in which scenes from the Bible were depicted. Adding stark drama to the lustrous upper portion of the room, natural light pierced the dark space through a central oculus, much like the one in Rome's Pantheon, assisted by a series of high, small, deeply recessed windows that threw shafts of illumination that were so focused and tight that they seemed almost solid, like structural beams propped at ever-changing angles. As Langdon walked with Sienna deeper into the room, he took in the legendary ceiling mosaic, a multi-tiered representation of heaven and hell, very much like the depiction in the Divine Comedy. Dante Alighieri saw this as a child, Langdon thought. Inspiration from above. Langdon fixed his gaze now on the centerpiece of the mosaic. Hovering directly above the main altar rose a 27-foot-tall Jesus Christ, seated in judgment over the saved and the damned. At Jesus' right hand,
the righteous received the reward of everlasting life. On his left hand, however, the sinful were stoned, roasted on spikes, and eaten by all manner of creatures. Overseeing the torture was a colossal mosaic of Satan portrayed as an infernal, man-eating beast. Langdon always flinched when he saw this figure, which more than 700 years ago had stared down at the young Dante Alighieri, terrifying him, and eventually inspiring his vivid portrayal of what lurked in the final ring of hell. The frightening mosaic overhead depicted a horned devil that was in the process of consuming a human being head first. The victim's legs dangled from Satan's mouth in a way that resembled the flailing legs of the half-buried sinners in Dante's Malebolge. L'imperador del doloroso regno, Langdon thought, recalling Dante's text, the emperor of the despondent kingdom. Slithering from the ears of Satan were two massive, writhing snakes, also in the process of consuming sinners, giving the impression that Satan had three heads, exactly as Dante described him in the final canto of his Inferno. Langdon searched his memory and recalled fragments of Dante's imagery. On his head he had three faces, his three chins gushing a bloody froth, his three mouths used as grinders, gnashing sinners three at once. That Satan's evil was threefold, Langdon knew, was fraught with symbolic meaning. It placed him in perfect balance with the threefold glory of the Holy Trinity. As Langdon stared up at the horrific sight, he tried to imagine the effect the mosaic had on the youthful Dante, who had attended services at this church year after year and seen Satan staring down at him each time he prayed. This morning, however, Langdon had the uneasy feeling that the devil was staring directly at him. He quickly lowered his gaze to the baptistry's second-story balcony and standing gallery, the lone area from which women were permitted to view baptisms, and then down to the suspended tomb of Antipope John XXIII, his body lying in repose high on the wall, like a cave dweller or a subject in a magician's levitation trick. Finally, his gaze reached the ornately tiled floor, which many believed contained references to medieval astronomy. He let his eyes move across the intricate black and white patterns until they reached the very center of the room. And there it is, he thought, knowing he was staring at the exact spot where Dante Alighieri had been baptized in the latter half of the 13th century. I shall return as poet at my baptismal font, Langdon declared, his voice echoing through the empty space. This is it. Sienna looked troubled as she eyed the center of the floor where Langdon was now pointing.
But there's nothing here.
Not anymore, Langdon replied. All that remained was a large, reddish-brown octagon of pavement. This unusually plain, eight-sided area clearly interrupted the pattern of the more ornately designed floor and resembled nothing so much as a large, patched-up hole, which, in fact, was precisely what it was. Langdon quickly explained that the baptistry's original baptismal font had been a large octagonal pool located at the very center of this room. While modern fonts were usually raised basins, earlier fonts were more akin to the literal meaning of the word font, springs or fountains, in this case a deep pool of water into which participants could be more deeply immersed. Langdon wondered what this stone chamber had sounded like as children screamed in fear while being literally submerged in the large pool of icy water that once stood in the middle of the floor. Baptisms here were cold and scary, Langdon said, true rites of passage. Dangerous, even. Allegedly, Dante once jumped into the font to save a drowning child. In any case, the original font was covered over at some point in the 16th century. Sienna's eyes now began darting around the building with obvious concern.
But if Dante's baptismal font is gone, where did Ignazio hide the mask?
Langdon understood her alarm. There was no shortage of hiding places in this massive chamber, behind columns, statues, tombs, inside niches, at the altar, even upstairs. Nonetheless, Langdon felt remarkably confident as he turned and faced the door through which they'd just entered. We should start over there, he said, pointing to an area against the wall just to the right of the gates of paradise.
On a raised platform behind a decorative gate, there sat a tall hexagonal plinth of carved marble, which resembled a small altar or service table. The exterior was so intricately carved that it resembled a mother-of-pearl cameo. Atop the marble base sat a polished wooden top with a diameter of about 3 feet. Sienna looked uncertain as she followed Langdon over to it. As they ascended the steps and moved inside the protective gate, Sienna looked more closely and drew a startled breath, realizing what she was looking at. Langdon smiled. Exactly, it's not an altar or table. The polished wooden top was, in fact, a lid, a covering for the hollow structure.
A baptismal font? She asked.
Langdon nodded. If Dante were baptized today, it would be in this basin right here. Wasting no time, he took a deep, purposeful breath and placed his palms on the wooden cover, feeling a tingle of anticipation as he prepared to remove it. Langdon tightly gripped the edges of the cover and heaved it to one side, carefully sliding the top off the marble base, placing it on the floor beside the font. Then he peered down into the 2-foot-wide, dark, hollow space within. The eerie sight made Langdon swallow hard. From out of the shadows, the dead face of Dante Alighieri was looking back at him. Chapter 56. Seek and ye shall find. Langdon stood at the rim of the baptismal font and stared down at the pale yellow death mask, whose wrinkled countenance gazed blankly upward. The hooked nose and protruding chin were unmistakable. Dante Alighieri. The lifeless face was disturbing enough, and yet something about its position in the font seemed almost supernatural. For a moment, Langdon was unsure what he was seeing. Is the mask hovering? Langdon crouched lower, peering more closely at the scene before him. The font was several feet deep, more of a vertical well than a shallow basin, its steep walls dropping down to a hexagonal repository that was filled with water. Strangely, the mask seemed to be suspended partway down the font, perched just above the surface of the water as if by magic. It took a moment for Langdon to realize what was causing the illusion. The font had a vertical central spindle that rose halfway up and flattened into a kind of small metal platter just above the water. The platter appeared to be a decorative fountainhead and perhaps a place to rest a baby's bottom, but it was currently serving as a pedestal on which the mask of Dante rested, elevated safely above the water. Neither Langdon nor Sienna said a word as they stood side by side gazing down at the craggy face of Dante Alighieri, still sealed in his Ziploc bag, as if he'd been suffocated. For a moment, the image of a face staring up out of a water-filled basin conjured for Langdon his own terrifying experience as a child, stuck at the bottom of a well, staring skyward in desperation. Pushing the thought from his mind, he carefully reached down and gripped the mask onto either side, where Dante's ears would have been. Although the face was small by modern standards, the ancient plaster was heavier than he'd expected. He slowly lifted the mask out of the font and held it up so that he and Sienna could examine it more closely. Even viewed through the plastic bag, the mask was remarkably lifelike. Every wrinkle and blemish of the old poet's face had been captured by the wet plaster. With the exception of an old crack down the center of the mask, it was in perfect condition.
"Turn it over," Sienna whispered. "Let's see the back."
Langdon was already doing just that. The security video from the Palazzo Vecchio had clearly shown Langdon and Ignazio discovering something on the reverse side of the mask, something of such startling interest that the two men had essentially walked out of the palace with the artifact. Taking exceptional care not to drop the fragile plaster, Langdon flipped the mask over and laid it face down in his right palm so they could examine the back. Unlike the weathered, textured face of Dante, the inside of the mask was smooth and bare. Because the mask was never meant to be worn, its backside had been filled in with plaster to give some solidity to the delicate piece, resulting in a featureless, concave surface, like a shallow soup bowl. Langdon didn't know what he had expected to find on the back of the mask, but it most certainly was not this. Nothing. Nothing at all. Just a smooth,
empty surface. Sienna seemed equally confused.
It's blank plaster, she whispered. If there's nothing here, what did you and Ignacio see?
I have no idea, Langdon thought, pulling the plastic bag taut across the plaster for a clearer view.
There's nothing here.
With mounting distress, Langdon raised the mask into a shaft of light and studied it closely. As he tipped the object over for a better view, he thought for an instant that he might have glimpsed a faint discoloration near the top, a line of markings running horizontally across the inside of Dante's forehead. A natural blemish? Or maybe something else? Langdon immediately spun and pointed to a hinged panel of marble on the wall behind them. Look in there, he told Sienna. See if there are towels. Sienna looked skeptical but obeyed, opening the discreetly hidden cupboard, which contained three items: a valve for controlling the water level in the font, a light switch for controlling the spotlight above the font, and a stack of linen towels. She gave Langdon a surprised look, but Langdon had toured enough churches worldwide to know that baptismal fonts almost always afforded their priests easy access to emergency swaddling cloths. The unpredictability of infants' bladders a universal risk of christenings. Good, he said, eyeing the towels. Hold the mask a second. He gently transferred the mask to Sienna's hands and then set to work. First, Langdon retrieved the hexagonal lid and heaved it back up onto the font to restore the small altar-like table they had first seen. Then he grabbed several of the linen towels from the cupboard and spread them out like a tablecloth. Finally, he flipped the font's light switch, and the spotlight directly overhead sprang to life, illuminating the baptismal area and shining brightly down on the covered surface. Sienna gently laid the mask on the font, while Langdon retrieved more towels, which he used like oven mitts to slide the mask from the Ziploc bag, careful not to touch it with his bare hands. Moments later, Dante's death mask lay unsheathed and naked, face up beneath the bright light, like the head of an anesthetized patient on an operating table. The mask's dramatic texturing appeared even more unsettling in the light, the creases and wrinkles of old age accentuated by the discolored plaster. Langdon wasted no time using his makeshift mitts to flip the mask over and lay it face down. The backside of the mask looked markedly less aged than the front, clean and white rather than dingy and yellow. Sienna cocked her head, looking puzzled.
Does this side look newer to you?
Admittedly, the color difference was more emphatic than Langdon would have imagined, but this side was most certainly the same age as the front. Uneven aging, he said. The back of the mask has been shielded by the display case, so has never suffered the aging effects of sunlight. Langdon made a mental note to double the SPF of his sunscreen.
Hold on,
Sienna said, leaning in close to the mask.
Look, on the forehead. That must be what you and Ignacio saw.
Langdon's eyes moved quickly across the smooth white surface to the same discoloration he had spied earlier through the plastic. A faint line of markings that ran horizontally across the inside of Dante's forehead. Now, however, in the stark light, Langdon saw clearly that these markings were not a natural blemish. They were man-made.
It's writing,
Sienna whispered, the words catching in her throat.
But